So the question we will discuss today is the kind of boundary in grammars between white dwarf formation and neutral star formation, which mass. And so let me start from some lecture style thing, because I was asked to give some introduction. And in my lecture at the University of Tokyo, which I will usually start from, of course, the Austrian evolution is hydrostatic equilibrium. And so what we will discuss is kind of polytrope and central the stellar mass m and the radius r, and central temperature is we center, so we just say it's pc rho c and pc. So the what we try is that to make a relation between kind of global structure quantity and the very local value of central some dynamical quantities. And so for that, so very roughly we approximate this as very simply this kind of things. And in addition, central density is somewhat approximately. This is given mass. So with these two equations, we can easily obtain so this is very fundamental equation to describe the evolution. And so if we assume ideal gas, for example, this gives a relation, the center temperature and density relation, which is proportional to mass square. And so if we plot, draw the line in this central temperature and density, and to give the so we have removed the radius, so it's basically a function of mass. So this gives constant mass line. Rho p c 1/3 rho c plus. So this is a 1/3. So higher mass is occupy this region, lower mass this side. And if you plot the entropy, some constant. This is M constant. In front, the entropy is different color. So entropy is constant line, which twice steeper. It's like this. So entropy is higher here. So the if star evolves by losing entropy by radiation, so central entropy is going to decrease. So the star evolves along this line with decreasing entropy, like this. And higher mass stars have higher entropy, lower mass stars have lower entropy. And then, so this is kind of so-called gravitational thermal catastrophe, because if, say, so if we use this relation to describe entropy, it goes to something like this. So if calculate kind of the specific heat, so-called gravitational specific heat for constant m, it's going to give right 2/3 or 3/3. So it, anyway, it's a negative specific heat. So with as a star loses entropy, the temperature going up, that's the so-called the negative specific heat. So this is a very fundamental thing for the star evolution. But if the equation of states changed, to go to this non-relativistic Dirichlet electron dominates the pressure, and put it here, this gives the central density just proportional to mass. So higher mass star has the highest density. So it's we describe here. Mass constant, mass is larger in this direction. So in between the if we calculate the finite temperature equation of state more exactly, we can just draw this line. And here, the entropy is only, we assume the electron entropy going to zero and only ions, and put into this goes to just m square. So this gives a specific the heat is positive. So that means that if we lose the star lose entropy, just temperature going down, positive. So this is an important dividing line between positive and negative and positive specific heat. So if this equation of state just continue to the ideal, we cannot avoid a gravitational collapse. As far as entropy is removing from the center. And Russian says this is a gravitational catastrophe. And this is right hand side is degenerate. So here of course, the special relativity works is important. That gives the equation of state this relation because of the velocity limited by the speed of light. Then this gives, by putting this into here, it gives Chandrasekhar limit. So y is an electron-mole fraction, famous one. So this is a very important quantity. So in between, there is evolution like this one, going to infinity. So the dividing by this Chandrasekhar mass, the star is divided into gravitational catastrophe or gravitational collapse and degenerate state. And in my course at the University of Tokyo, we ask students to draw this exact line, not just two lines. So then they can obtain kind of ignition, critical ignition. If we say in the coming lecture, for example, this ignition line is for hydrogen and helium relative energy loss is important, but for later burning, the epsilon nuclei is the exact neutrino loss rate in pair. So that gives good approximation for the ignition point. So the student can derive the critical mass for the nuclear ignition. The complication is here, up to this point, the student can easily calculate, but to get this maximum temperature as a function of mass. So temperature maximum as a function of mass we can obtain. Then some critical mass for carbon burning, neon burning, and so on. So I think for helium is some, for hydrogen 0.08, helium I forgot exact number, something like 0.35, carbon 1.07, neon is 0.17 solar mass. So it's a good exercise for the students. And but more realistically, the situation is more complicated because the temperature structure is now depends on all these specific heat. So if we plot the temperature distribution, say, from the center outward, so usually there is a gradient like this one and relatively or convectively. But if central region becomes degenerate and the specific heat becomes positive and outer layer is still negative, usually if specific heat is positive, negative, for example, neutrino loss cooling, they even increase the temperature. However, if the central region is become degenerate, the specific heat become positive, so the temperature is now going down by emitting neutrinos that lose by losing entropy. So, but outer layers still can contract, so that gives temperature inversion like this one. So the ignition takes place not at the center, but somewhere in the outer shells. So that makes the situation is a bit complicated, and these values, critical mass is both carbon and neon case of center burning, of center ignition. So the central part is a bit cooled down because of the neutrinos. So basically, up to this point is the exercise by the students, and but afterwards we need some numerical simulations, and especially the complication is the stars. I don't remember exactly the number, something like 8 solar mass. The CO core is 1.07. And carbon burning is ignited in the shell, and it forms a convective region.
Question. Yes. Don't you get off-center ignition for helium burning too?
Sometimes, yes.
Flashes?
Yeah. I think I have seen some calculations. I didn't get such phase by myself, but I have seen such example. It also makes a bit disparities. I'm not completely sure. This
it depends on whether it's degenerate or non-degenerate ignition, right?
Okay, but in any low-mass star evolving up through a giant brain,
right.
You get off-center.
But then you get a bigger helium mass, too. It's not 0.35.
Yeah.
It's 0.48.
Yeah.
So anyway, now recently the whole discussion is taking place, the behavior of this carbon binding shell. And when I was calculating this evolution with my old code,
it's worth mentioning that if you get central carbon ignition, if you were to get that at slightly lower masses, that would give you a thermonuclear runaway, like in the type 1A.
Also, if it goes a bit higher mass, this temperature inversion does not occur because it's non-degenerate. So it's always central carbon burning is ignited. So there are some also critical mass between of center burning and central burning, some mass dependence. So in all calculations, this the temperature is getting higher in the outer layers because of the carbon burning. And so there's a heat conduction from outer layers to inward. So this heat conduction promoted the inward propagation of carbon frame. Very quiet burning, we say frame, but not quiet, but not really a detonation. So in most cases, it reaches the center. So afterwards, outer layers become oxygen, neon, magnesium, but eventually it forms whole oxygen, neon, magnesium core and some CO, the outer layers. But recently, the people are suggesting propagation of the convective carbon binding shell is kind of stopped by, I don't know exactly what's happening, but it's a kind of undershooting. So if the convective mixing exceeds this boundary and bring the carbon back into the outer layers, and if carbon fraction is really small between this burning layer and the under layer, so because of this undershooting, then even with heat conduction, there is no carbon here, so the the propagation of the carbon bond layer is stopped. So if that occurs, there is a possibility, at least some mass range, there is a possibility some carbon oxygen core at the center and oxygen neon on medium layer outward and some outer layer showing this kind of relation. And if this event happening in the binary systems and forming, or later if the star loses envelope to become quite dwarf, there is a word so-called hybrid white dwarf. So that usually means that the white dwarf consists of central carbon oxygen layer cores and outer oxygen layers.
But it's worth mentioning that possibility has been disputed. But I wouldn't say people agree that you can make these hybrid white dwarfs. There's a few reasons you can't.
One paper I just noticed is
right, and even if you make it, it might the neon. I think the sodium or neon. There's something that's heavier in the outer layers that might.
That's a group work. Here, the Y is lower. This configuration is so Y is lower and Y is almost 0.5. So, in a sense, it's a bit heavier element is on outside. If the layer is pulled down, this becomes relatively unstable. That's one suggestion. So this is a question, and at least carbon fraction, if there's a mixing, at least some carbon, carbon abundance could be very much reduced, they say. So the behavior of this convective boundary is sort of not well understood yet, in a sense, controversial. So final outcome still, so there is a possibility that oxygen magnesium core or white dwarf is formed, or this kind of hybrid white dwarf may or may not form. This is one situation. So the similar thing happening for the basically oxygen neon magnesium ore. And for this core also of center neon burning. Could be ignited in some range, and in this case, this binding shell convective layer is propagating inward. This case is not due to heat conduction, but contraction, gravitational contraction of the core. The core is contracting and heats up the outer layers, and that promotes the nuclear burning, and that burning layers propagate inward. So the mechanism is a bit different from carbon, between carbon and neon. So in any case, and there is a mass range, of course. Central neon burning is ignited first.
Is it intuitive why neon ignites before oxygen? Is it a resonance? It's a resonance that means you know.
It's a resonance.
Somebody answer that loudly so the rest of us can hear. You say what too?
It's because oxygen, the oxygen nucleus is a double magic nucleus, and it's hard to break. So it's why you burn first neon.
So When temperature goes up, then neon starts to photodisintegrate. Yes. That's how it starts.
Yeah. And it's, it doesn't happen with the oxygen because it's hard to photodisintegrate.
So final configuration in those cases, kind of silicon-rich core is formed. And in some case, in some calculations, the next step is the silicon is ignited off-center and forming iron outer layers and silicon-rich core here. Something like this kind of inversion is seen in some models. So all this shell burning, I don't think it's completely well understood yet because of some instabilities and so on, and that we really study. So, but naive one-dimensional stellar evolution calculation predicts several this kind of variations. So, I have to speed up. So, this is kind of very basic for the evolution lectures, and but it's more complicated now. This kind of thing, it's important mass range is 8 to 10, or depending on the metallicity and the rotation and so on. So some people say 9 to 11, 7 to 9 or something. But in these cases, this goes to so-called super AGB phase, which means the oxygen neon magnesium is not small. When I was calculating, I was using alpha networks, so it's magnesium up, but now sodium is more important, of course. This goes to become degenerate. And there is some CO layers. Originally, there is a helium layer, but as the core becomes degenerate, there is a dredge up of the helium layer. Second dredge up. So whole core is very similar to the so-called AGB stars, and very thin helium layer present. So that goes to thermal pulses. Helium burning. And then the whole core grows to getting close to Chandrasekhar limit. And this evolution is slow because of nuclear burning time scale. So there is the enough time for the mass loss taking place. So the whole structure is here, the hydrogen envelope, very thin helium, and CO and oxygen neon cores. And this undergoes pulses, some dredge up taking place. And there is enough time for the envelope mass is lost. So the big question is this, if this, at which phase, or if oxygen core can reach the Chandrasekhar limit before losing the full hydrogen rich envelope. Initially, this mass, including helium layer, is mass is less than Chandrasekhar limit. So if star loses the envelope, it goes just white dwarf. But if the still hydrogen envelope is kept, or some helium layer also kept in some cases, then the core can grow to Chandrasekhar limit, the interesting event happen. So assuming the central density just goes to, can increase up to 10 to 10, the weak interaction becomes important, so electron capture. Magnesium, neon, and also sodium, but it goes to beta decay also taking place, so Ulka process. Electron capture and beta decay almost simultaneously. So this electron capture taking place when the electron Fermi energy is going up in central density. Then some nucleus becomes unstable to electron capture because the some nucleus usually people like this one. Mass number and a charge, and there's a, so you, this is energy scale. So in laboratory, this is unstable and just goes to this ground state. But at high, strongly electron degenerate cases, if we add electron energy, if we plot the so-called electron distribution functions, can we drag way? So this gives some temperature, finite temperature psychology. So and Fermi energy is something like here. So electron is captured by daughter nucleus. So that is more favorable in terms of energy. So this electron capture starts to take place. And that reduces the electrons while it is going down. But at the same time, there is another effect. In many cases, there is excited states. Electron capture is taking place on the excited states, so it's going the decay into the ground state, so that emits the gamma ray. And because of several reasons, the electron capture alone is a heating place, but this gamma ray emission is the most important heat source for the electron capture. So these electron capture going to the basically neon oxygen ignition. But the case of the sodium is, and for example, is different. This neon 23 becomes also temperature is, there is some threshold, if temperature is zero, threshold density exceeds the electron capture taking place, and a bit lower density, the beta decay is taking place. So net effect is just emission of the neutrino pair. So this is so-called cooling. This takes taking place at finite temperature, of course. And if we plot the rate, and as a function of central density. So for finite temperatures, there is some threshold. It's going like this. And so electron capture taking place efficiently at if density is getting higher, of course. And the beta decay is inversely occurs, this one. And this is for some given temperatures. And the combined effect is, if you multiply these two, it's like this one. So the around threshold, there is a very efficient Ulrika process. This process almost goes to simultaneously and emitting of neutrino pairs. And this is very important cooling effect. And but heating also means YE is also decreasing, so the core is also contracting. So the process is getting complicated, but more complication is the So when I recently restarted this work together with the Sam Jones, who are visiting with Rafael Hirsch to our institute, and Sam was using Mesa code, and already got some results for this mass range. And I was surprised he was using old order table for the electron capture. So order table, it has gives weak rates, but the grid point is something like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, 10 to 10. So only these are the grid points. And that didn't catch this threshold density at all. So with all order tables, some didn't see any significant Ulrika cooling at all. So we suggested, we asked our nuclear physicists to recalculate the weak rates and make much finer tables and to implement into the Mesa code. Then there's a lot of cooling is found. And that work has not really been published yet, but we will see the result. That cooling is probably very important, especially for relatively low carbon abundance. So that we have to be cautious, we have to be careful when just using Mesa code. We have to check all input physics by ourselves.
These cores, when you have the Ulrika process, they are not convective, are they?
No.
No.
It's just cooling.
Just cooling.
So central region is kind of dramatically cooled down around this threshold. And there it takes a, of course, later it's going temperature heating up, but this cooling is very sensitive to this profile.
So it occurs to how the cooling is well known to what degree. I mean, if everything is really dependent on how fast is the cooling, how well the cooling is known?
I think the rate itself is probably now well known by nuclear physicists.
It's capture rate. Probably fine, right?
I'm just asking.
I think it's fine. Implementation may be harder, but
So implementation to the code is what we should be very careful. Now, the So electron capture is more complicated. So, for example, neon case is again it's a heating effect. So threshold densities at zero temperature is something like this value, very close to 10 to the 10th. And we plot the central density temperature diagram. It's very cold, for example. The electron capture starts to heat up the central region. Then the one important complication is the now temperature is going up. Looks like convectively unstable, but also y is decreasing. So this is kind of semi-convection region. So in my old calculation, very initially, we tried the Schwarzschild criterion. So there is some mixing, and the central temperature density going up and like this. And then there is a neon and oxygen. Well, in this case, oxygen because of the higher density. The oxygen flash taking place. Something like the 2 × 10^10 in terms of central density. But if we take just the Duff criterions, the inhibits the mixing, then temperature just continues going up. With in our code, it's not so sophisticated, so we just tried both. So center kind of nuclear flash taking place at this density. And for this case, there's no problem, just going to collapse.
Sorry, can I just clarify again? So depending on whether you have the dual Schwarzschild, you can either have a collapse or...
Yeah, it's a bit sensitive. That's why I will show you a bit later. So what is happening in the central region after nuclear flash first? So there's a hot region temperature is almost 10^10. So a lot of free, basically it's a nuclear statistical equilibrium and a lot of free proton there. So the so this kind of very tiny region is burned. How tiny is, we don't know, but the important thing is the electron capture is taking place basically protons, free protons, and some ion. So at least half is due to protons, so the Ye is decreasing in the center. At the same time, it heat up. So the core tries to both ways. Because of due to heat, it tries to expand or at least propagate outward. And because of the lower Ye and the neutrino loss, it drives the contraction. It's a competitive process. So at the central densities, somewhat higher than 10^10. I think which is the case for the Schwarzschild criterion. It's all the calculations of the scraps. But if we stop the central ignition, it's 9.95. It's very sensitive. for the competing process. But still the question is how much mixing takes place and it drives the core to higher density due to the electron captures. And the complication is there's a sharp temperature jump here. And Y also has a jump. So ordinary estimate for the time scale doesn't work usually. We have to be careful about this treatment. And Philip Edelman is using so-called Roman-Hanaba code to simulate this process, but he said it takes a time to get answer yet. So, but it's an important question, how much mixing and how much takes place and how much going to up here or like this one. And the time scale is initially rather slow process. But after higher temperatures, because of the nuclear burning, the process is speed up. So in the end, I think no mixing taking place completing the nuclear burning, but early phase already important here, how much mixing taking place. And for this case, now the in 1D, at this higher density, so we have to follow the so-called oxygen deflagration. And initially, it's almost laminar frame. Laminar means no, just conductive front. Conduction heats up the next layer to burn up. And then in 1D, we can resolve this calculation. So the also almost the micron zoning, 10 to the minus 6 meter zone we have to set, and so-called subgrid approach. So conductive velocity is something like roughly 100 kilometers per second, which is about 1/10 of the sound speed. So with these slow velocities, at least in 1D, it's going to collapse. But there is some, after some time, it's going to develop into convective instability is growing. And so this process is not completely settled yet, but if we apply the standard mixing length approach, still going to collapse, which I found in 1D. But now there are two calculations. The 3D Sammy-Jones is here. I think there is a poster at the conference. And he tried the central ignition density to, probably not to 1.5, but 10.2, 1.95, 1.9, okay. So what he did is sort of in the central regions, he pays more mass, but he put 300 kind of bubbles to start the convection, relative instability kind of perturbation. And then he found, as usual, this is the graphs. And these two cases, he got a kind of white dwarf remnant and partial explosion. So I asked the.
Just clarify. So you have a convective core, that's the idea?
Initially, it should be laminar.
But now it's convective.
So he put these kind of bubbles everywhere.
So I'm wondering, where would the Urca shell be in that?
Urca shell is much out of range already. Here, this is assumptions, see. Nuclear flash taking place at this density. Just to start at central density and high temperature, something like 10 to 10.
Did he suggest what the partial explosion would look like?
It's possibly like so-called type 1 AX-like. But it produces lots of the extremely neutron-rich ion peak elements mixed out. So in terms of the chemical evolution, it's not so good. So in 3D now, in the group, the because 3D expensive, it is extremely expensive and not good for parameter search. So we tried some parameter search for various densities and burning conditions. One example in 2D is he assumed and this kind of this is also very tiny region. 10 to the minus 5 square mass or something, a very small region. But he put this kind of frame structure and to initiate the calculation. So what he got is the peak loss is 9.90. Basically, it does go into problem. So I think the important thing is initially it's laminar, that is clear. But, and because of the very strong electron degeneracy, the buoyancy force is extremely small in the central region. And because temperature does not affect much to the pressure. So how the time scale to go into convective is still important question. And how to simulate this phase in 1D, 2D, 3D is still not completely settled yet. But
can you compare that to the type 1A ignition?
Type 1A is basically 9.45.
Okay. But the physics of it, is it similar or is it like the...
I think it's already, from the beginning, it's easy to start convective motion.
But in the type 1A, we know that it's very dependent on geometry, also ignition, for example, what the outcome is. Would that be expected here as well?
I think structure is not so similar because it's really conductive in the central region. So I don't know how the deformation is important, but, and how this initial perturbation is affected.
Quite similar. I would have thought it would be similar. What's the size of the burning front?
Yeah, the size is the one difference is this is oxygen and the one is carbon. But so if we try to resolve the frame structure. We need much finer zone for oxygen. But that's also that people are now studying also. The difference between oxygen and carbon. Very basic physics is the same, yes. But the importance of the transition from laminar to convective.
Sorry, Ken, it's not obvious to me why you need higher resolution for the oxygen front. Why is it now?
Probably about this, because the carbon is more the explosive. So the time scale of the nuclear burning versus the conductive time scale. So it's that gives the size of the layer from burning front. And there is some also controversy about the Coulomb factors at this high density. I found some difference between our Japanese the collections and the Russians. So those basic physics still we have to check just before implementing into the code. So this is kind of situation we have found. So still I believe it's very likely to get graphs, but it's important to get observational constraints. And already there are some questions. If there's a graph, if this is kind of explosions, it's supernova 1.5 type. But 1.5 and X.
1.5 have hydrogens, right?
Yeah. And X is this white remnant is four. And the graph case, probably people will discuss. It's sort of very weak explosions. And people are calculating the neutron heating easily get explosions, but the energy is probably less than 10 to the fifth. So what my suggestion was in 1982 was this might be the Crab Nebula. So the Crab Nebula's explosion expanding energy is only 10 to the 49 order. It's not really supernova. And as far as I remember, its heavy element is not so much. Yeah, when I was working at Goddard Space Flight Center as a postdoc, the IUE team asked me, they measured the carbon abundance in the Crab Nebula, which is more like a solar. So they asked me if you can give constraints. And what I thought it could be the ejection of the super AGB like envelope, not from the core.
So we have 2008S, right? We have supernova 2008S now, right?
Could be. And I got interested in the monthly talk with a so-called spirits.
Yeah, spirits.
So super AGB can be obscured by the dust shells before the explosion. So could be hided by dust shells before the explosion. And even after the explosions, it could be observed only in the near infrared. So I'm just very much interested in this one.
I think we need to
So this is just introduction.
Maybe relating to the question, how often do we expect this kind of outcome? So, unfortunately, we almost lost Ken's nice diagram, but if we still resurrect it a little bit, then we had log rho c here, log tc here, and Yeah, the line's still there, so we can still recover it. See, so this was the evolution to white dwarfs. This is the evolution to core collapse. And this is evolution to electron capture. And the question is, you know, how many stars do that? And so what we did is not looking at all these complicated late evolutionary things, but just this function of the initial mass of the star. We looked at the helium core mass, and if you do that at a time of the evolution where helium burning is just ending, for example, you get what you expect, the line like this. So let's put some numbers here, like 5 solar masses. 10, 15, and I don't know, 10 solar masses, I may have 3, 1, something like that. And so there is one trick here in this diagram, which Ken didn't mention. The mass is going up, but the question is which mass? It's not the mass of the star anymore if you look at the late stages, it's the mass of the cores of the stars, right? And so we could imagine, or we could say that maybe we consider helium core mass or so. We would go to still later stages, we should put carbon oxygen core mass or something like that. So what you see is actually when the stars evolve, they kind of switch to lower mass curves, because initially it's the hydrogen mass, then it switches to helium core mass and so on. And so there is a certain mass range in helium core masses, which perhaps does the electron capture path. And if we look at the numerical calculations, Ken's, for example, and others as well, I don't know, this is somewhere, gives somewhere a mass range. Now, what you cannot do is to go from here to estimate the initial mass range for electron capture supernovae, because still also here was the second dredge up. So what happens at the in the evolution of the stars when they finish core helium burning is we have the mirror principle of stellar evolution. The core contracts, the envelope expands. The stars climb up the Hayashi line. The more they do that, the more the convective envelope comes down, and it dredges up the helium core if it gets the time. So what we this is at core helium exhaustion. If we do the same line. I don't know, maybe at a central temperature of the order of 9.5 or so, then this line will look different. It turns out that the massive stars, they would also do a second dredge up if they if the core would evolve slowly enough, but actually the core collapses so quickly that the envelope has no time to do that. So this line is retained up to a mass from which on the second dredge up is happening before the end of the life of the star. When it's happening, it's quite drastic. And so you get something like this. Do I exaggerate, Philip?
A little bit, but that's fine.
Okay. And as a result of this, the helium cores in the white mass range are much, much smaller in the final evolutionary stages. And so instead of having an initial mass range for electron capture supernovae like this, you only get a very tiny mass range where the helium core masses are suitable to go into the electron capture regime here. We did some simplified evolutionary considerations also in a study led by Arend-Jan Pularens, which investigated this in more detail. It depends on a couple of other factors, like the thermal pulsing, the super AGV phase, and so on. And one can, you know, find a certain variation of this number or of this mass range depending on what physics one assumes there. But in any case, it turns out for single stars it's really small. It's of the order of a few tenths of solar masses, maybe only one tenth of solar mass.
That's no matter how you change the physics, the mixing, anything.
Well, we varied a couple of things. Probably one could vary other parameters. So it's not a comprehensive study in that sense, but.
You also showed that at lower metallicity, the range becomes much bigger. Can you remind me why that was?
maybe afterwards, but let's consider one effect first. Which is the binary effect, which I think is the more important thing here. So what is said here is true for single stars, and the point is that in order to get this dredge up, you need a massive hydrogen-rich envelope. And if the star has lost its hydrogen-rich envelope before or at the time of core helium exhaustion, this dredge up will not happen simply. And, you know, the relation for binaries will be a little different because your helium core, for example, if you have case B evolution, your helium core will not grow during core helium burning, while in single stars it does. But essentially, the message is that in single stars you get a very small mass range, but in binaries you essentially recover the full mass range for electron capture supernovae. And so the ratio of electron capture supernovae from binaries over that from single stars should be a large number. So if I would look for electron capture supernovae somewhere in the universe, I would look in the type 1a regime, not in the type 2 regime. That's more likely.
Norbert? Mm-hmm. So you said in single stars you get this few tenths of solar masses range. How much is it in binaries? Do you have a number for that one?
It's two solar masses, three solar masses, something like that.
It's not from five like you draw.
That's secret.
Sorry, I'm not prepared, so I don't remember the mass range on top of that. But
it's probably a bit smaller than what we had in that paper, because we, of course, didn't consider case BB mass transfer in there. Right? So that will reduce the range.
Yeah, so there's one uncertainty in the binaries case, which is true, which one should mention. If we look at the lower mass range here, what happens is we have relatively small helium stars, and those helium stars can expand significantly due to helium shell burning. again, the mirror principle, stellar evolution. And this can have two effects. One is if the helium star is in a binary, then it will lose part of its helium envelope. So the total helium star mass is reduced late in the stage. So it slides down the scale here, so to speak. And even if we consider such star in isolation or in a white binary, what is pretty uncertain is whether there is mass loss by stellar winds from such helium giants or helium supergiants. We don't observe them really, so we don't have observational constraints. But of course, the more the helium giant expands, the less bound is the envelope, and maybe the more likely it is that mass loss can carry away some of the mass. So there's a caveat in the binary scenario too. Overall, I would still expect many more electron capture supernovae from binaries.
So I think the favorite candidate now for an electron capture supernova is from this dusty ATB star. So you're saying that would surprise you, right? That most of these electron capture candidates should not be from dusty ATB stars.
One case can always be accommodated,
but if that's the mass range from 5 to 10, they should be very, very common, huh? Given the IMF binary friction.
Yeah, I think in binaries it shouldn't be really a rare event. It should be quite common indeed.
So are you suggesting that in these calcium rich, fast and faint events, there are always remote regions of galaxies and so on, spherical fraction could be binary electron capture supernovae?
I'm not sure I would suggest it for the calcium rich supernovae. So what is true is we would expect a fast and faint supernova. Ken has argued that the explosion energy may be small in these events, which is true also if we remove the envelope. And if we don't have an extended hydrogen-rich envelope, then it means also the explosion is faint. There's also very little nickel expected. So there's nothing which could make the supernova bright. So it's in the fast and faint regime of type 1As. But there, we still have a few types of things. And the calcium-rich ones, well, they are very remote. So we would need to find the evolutionary time, you know, to have the object move out of a galaxy very far away. I think the progenitor time for these guys may not be long enough.
I think some of the optical transits which are linked will limit their less than supernova targets to the electron supernova, because they claim that the progenitor most likely would be like 8 to 10 solar mass star, just based on the range of star formation and stuff like that.
Right.
But we didn't see anything which would be related to the supernova itself, like looking or anything, just the energy.
What about 1A axis? Could these produce 1A axis?
Perhaps, yeah. That's the ones which we have in our eye, actually, to consider for this. But
don't those produce some nickel? I don't know.
I think they do.
It's quite a diversity of things.
Yeah, it's a diversity.
All these names refer to about the same things. You got to pick better than just using one. I mean, that's why I threw a few names that I deliberately didn't use or you used. There's a lot of diversity. If you dredge up, you produce then a lot of oxygen, neon, magnesium, white dwarfs, because they do not go to supernova, the single stars.
That's right, yeah.
The single stars produce a lot of oxygen, neon, magnesium, white dwarfs. What would be the ratio of carbon oxygen to oxygen neon magnesium white dwarfs? Is it easy to estimate the ratio of numbers? Is it really from 5 to 10?
It's not 5 to 10.
No, it's
it's about, depends on the overshooting, you assume.
Yeah.
It's a range of about 3 solar masses.
3 solar masses, but still a lot.
That's still a lot, you're right. Yeah,
yeah, and that's right. Very nice, because in globular clusters you see young pulsars I mean, it's quite a lot of young process also in globular clusters. And in order to make them, I think Philip also suggested that if one of these oxygen magnesium white dwarfs, they're pretty heavy, they sink to the center of the globular cluster, they capture another star, they get accretion, and then they can collapse and make a young pulsar in the globular cluster. Mm-hmm. So if you have a lot of them, that is a process that you would expect to happen sometimes.
That diagram still depends on mass flows, so it depends on the density. Because the if no mass flow from AGD was supposed to take place, the helium layer must can grow by double shell binding.
Yes. That's the process which Philip was
going up and going into the capture.
Yes.
So the question is if the hydrogen helium double shell binding can to what extent increase
mass,
so that depends on the mass flows.
Absolutely right.
So
that's essentially the.
I think this is kind of very extreme assumption with almost everything lost.
Yes.
You
neglected this increase. Yes. I do. That's the question Philip asked. So what is the metallicity dependence? And indeed, so at low metallicity, this effect may play a bigger role, and then you may have more electron capture supernovae from single stars. I think the last word on the metallicity dependence of the mass of the AGB mass loss has still not been cast, so I don't know whether we have anybody who can educate us about that. But we did in the study with Polarens, we did assume a metallicity dependence of this of the AGB mass loss rate, and then this effect comes up. There's some people which argue that, well, the carbon in the envelopes of these super AGB stars is primary, and then it shouldn't depend on the metallicity if that's the main dust producer and the main agent to lose the mass. So that's, I think that's still open. I think observationally that question is probably not decided yet.
Even for solar metallicity, the mass loss rate from super AGB is not known.
No, I think not.
So still we can assume that increase of the helium core.
Sure.
Without mass flow.
Yes.
Because the for example, 10 solar mass has lots of hydrogen with gem when it forms oxygen core already.
No.
So even if mass flow is quite high, it still keeps a few solar mass envelope when the core reaches the centrifugal limit. It's possible, I
see. Agreed.
Just one additional comment why we are so interested in this is because these electron capture supernovae, all of them have small ion cores, the same thing. They are easy to explode. And if Thierry is right, the supernova kicks have something to do with how easy it is to explode a star, you wouldn't expect large supernova kicks. So these are more easily retained, for example, in globular clusters.
And double neutron star system, it's clear also the binary effect, you know, plays a big role.
Yeah. As Ed has been arguing for a long time, most of the second neutron stars born in double neutron star systems probably have low.
And
Skillet
also
and low masses, right?
And low masses.
Can binarity change also the cooling processes in the core, if the mass transfer happens early enough in the evolution?
No, I don't think so. I think it's simply the mass of the core which is responsible for that. The carbon-oxygen core does not see whether there is a extended hydrogen envelope on top of it or not.
No, but I'm thinking that it could have, for the same mass, a different temperature and density structure.
Well, in principle, I guess, you know, depending when you change your core mass by dredge up or other processes, you can get some wiggles in these curves up or down. So, in principle, perhaps it's not excluded, but I don't really see at the moment where this where we've got a big effect from that.
So,
if you were to lose it during helium core burning, for example, then there could be a different evolutionary path, but it's not likely to happen during helium core burning.
But if you go to the range of a lower mass helium cores, right? So those like two or roughly two solar masses, they would have standard giants, right? So in this case, if you go for the helium conversion stage, you will not burn the old helium in the same way as you will burn it if you have a hydrogen globule, no? Because you expanded some helium as you will be high helium CO core. So you say it doesn't matter with the amount of CO core. At the end of the helium core burning will be the same for two solar masses, helium star, whether it's inside or outside of hydrogen level?
Well, you end up with a different helium core mass at the end of core helium evolution. But I think that mass is then the deciding number for what happens. And maybe you have some secondary effects that your carbon to oxygen ratio could be a little bit different. Yeah, that's one thing. I think you get more oxygen if your helium core grows as a function of time and less.
I actually wasn't really about the CO ratio, but for example, you take two solar mass helium core, which will be inside seven or eight solar mass stars, like hydrogen normal. So you evolve it through the giants, it created these two helium, it doesn't burn yet, and it's stripped it, end of all. So it's either two inside eight solar masses, or it's two next to the another companion in the binary. But if it's in a companion in the binary, then it starts to evolve, it will expand. So some mass of the helium will become an envelope.
Oh, sure.
Which is not burning, right?
That's what Philip was alluding to. That's a so-called case BB mass loss scenario, or mass transfer scenario. So if the helium star in the end expands, it may lose some of its envelope. And yes, that can change the final mass. Reduce the final mass and move the stars in this direction. Anyway, that's all I really have to say. So.
Nothing else to say?
Okay, Philip, can I then return to something you mentioned earlier? Okay, question?
Great.
Or, I don't know, for either of you. So you mentioned that you think that the second born nucleus star. Actually,
but we had discussed it before.
Yes, but exactly. I thought we had discussed it before, and I thought you could actually convince me that it was actually more important to the first born nucleus star to have a low kick, not the second born one. Because the binary is much wider, and you will disproportionately, for the second born nucleus star, let's say if you're talking about something like GO737, right, with a few hour orbital period, you can get a kick, you can get away with a kick of, the orbital velocity is several hundred kilometers per second, right, so you can get away with it.
My
statement
was just an observational one.
Right.
Therefore, the second born neutron stars, I think we can make a good case that they have low kicks. For the first explosion, I think it's more important. But we don't know that. But that's where the exobine is coming.
And there you see that there is a population as well, kicks.
Exactly. That's right. That's what. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, okay. But you're fair enough. It requires some more modeling in the sense that you have to assume that the binary was considerably wider when the first neutron star was formed. But if you assume that, then you would actually. That would actually suggest that that is even more crucial to the first neutron star being able to avoid disruption.
Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted to check that. Thank you.
And the point being is that in the first supernova, you have wide systems, and if you give them all large kicks, then 99% of them are disrupted. If you have some of them with small kicks, then it may only be 90%. And that's a factor of 10 difference in neutron star merger rates.
Maybe it's a good moment to emphasize the fact that having a small kick is not evidence for a small electron capture.
It could be a small ion core, sure.
No, it can be even any core collapse. Because the distribution is a stochastic variable. So just consider one case, distribution of kicks for the best SASE scenario is
includes zero velocity. It's a very wide distribution which has the right mean value, the right maximum value compared to observations, but it really goes down to zero. So it's only on statistical arguments that you can rule out normal core collapse based on kicks, but not on a single event.
Which is not for many sensors.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
but though electron captures not have systematically lower kicks in the simulations than the other ones?
This is true, but if you have a lower kick, it does not imply, if you have a small kick on one individual, it does not imply some electron capture.
Once we fully understand your core collapse calculations, we can answer.
Well, this may be an argument. But the distribution of masses of
No,
I agree. This can be an important argument. But the distribution of masses of normal core collapse is not considered as a very reliable outcome of the simulation yet. But yeah, I agree. This can be an important argument.
Can electron capture still give large things?
No.
No, so there must be a distribution then, what you get, and which is different.
Yes, but there is a big overlap in the low kick regions. There's a big overlap.
Thierry, how do you get around the fact that if you do have assessing stability, right, by definition you have a significant amount of asymmetry, so how do you get around getting a significant kick in that case?
Because there is, it's really the paper by Czech 2006, which studied, 100 outcomes of 2D simulations. And those results have been confirmed as far as possible with 3D simulations by another one. And they really identified the fact that the explosion energy is not the stochastic variable, but the kick velocity is a stochastic variable.
Now, I would say that particular distribution is not consistent with the pulsar velocities observed.
Isn't it?
I mean, you get a fairly flat distribution in the Czech paper, and that's not consistent with the distribution observations of single radio pulses that don't have such a tail.
So, which is consistent, right? I mean, you only do electron captures at the known binaries, and you don't get
single. Sure, of course. And that's why you need to look. That's what I've told you. You also need to look at the single pulses. So they come mainly from wide disrupted binaries. Anyway, there's a lot of information in there, and population synthesis can be useful for it.
Finish.